12 o'clock. Time for the news, read by John Shea.
The Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, has defended a number of gifts given to the Labour leadership, insisting the party has been transparent about donations. She denies breaking parliamentary rules while staying in an apartment belonging to the Labour donor, Lord Alley, during a holiday in New York. There have also been questions about clothes given to Ms. Rayner and Sir Keir Starmer by the peer, who was given a Downing Street security pass despite not having a government role. Separately, Angela Rayner denied reports of infighting at 10 Downing Street between Sir Keir's Chief of Staff, Sue Gray, and other officials. Ms. Rayner said the government was focused on delivering. In the past half hour, she's addressed the Labour Party conference in Liverpool with a promise to protect public services. Israel has come under attack from a barrage of about 100 rockets fired by Hezbollah in Lebanon, as well as drones launched by a pro-Iranian group in Iraq. The Israeli army said some of the rockets were intercepted, but there have been reports of Hezbollah rockets coming down further into Israel than before, including close to the port city of Haifa. At least three people have been injured. Palestinian health officials say at least seven people have been killed in a former school sheltering displaced families in Gaza City. The Israeli military says the strike on the Al-Shati refugee camp targeted Hamas fighters there and that steps were taken to minimise civilian casualties. At least four people have died and dozens have been injured in a mass shooting last night in the US state of Alabama. Several gunmen opened fire on a crowd in a popular entertainment area in the city of Birmingham. No suspects have been arrested and the motive isn't known. The White House says President Biden will soon announce new executive action to curb gun violence. The Crown Prosecution Service says it twice considered bringing charges against the former Harrods owner Mohammed Al-Fayed. The CPS says on both occasions it concluded there was no realistic prospect of a conviction. Dozens of women have come forward with allegations of being sexually assaulted or raped by the billionaire who died last year. Veterans and members of the armed forces are being joined by the Princess Royal at the Oosterbeek War Cemetery in the Netherlands today to mark the 80th anniversary of Operation Market Garden. In 1944, thousands of Allied troops parachuted into Nazi-occupied territory with the aim of securing crucial bridges over the River Rhine. They failed and suffered heavy losses. And the weather. There'll be outbreaks of showery rain across the south of England and eastern Wales, with a risk of thunder for some. It'll be dry in Northern Ireland, Scotland and the north of England, with sunshine developing from the west. Temperatures will reach highs of 19 degrees Celsius in London, 17 in Cardiff and Belfast, and 14 in Edinburgh. And that's the news and weather at 3 minutes past 12. Sarah Moore Peaches here a little later with Music Map, the featured composer this week, Gustav Holst. That's at 1:30. But first, Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Jay Rayner has his dream job. He loves writing and he loves food, and for the past 25 years, he's been the restaurant critic for The Observer. Jay is also familiar as a broadcaster, appearing as a judge on MasterChef and hosting The Kitchen Cabinet on Radio 4. His recent book, Nights Out at Home, provides recipes to allow us to create some of his favourite restaurant dishes in our own kitchens. Jay, you have a very public musical passion because you perform as a jazz pianist, leading your own band in venues around the country. And you've brought us some wonderful music as part of your menu on Private Passions today, including Rimsky-Korsakov and a classic Broadway overture. But we're going to start with a piece by the legendary pianist Michel Petrucciani. Why this?
I just like it. I am a writer. I sit at home at my desk writing. I can't write to a lyric, so no singers allowed in my room. And I am a pianist, a jazz pianist, and I have a whole succession of jazz pianists I listen to. And Michel Petrucciani is just extraordinary. What's particularly extraordinary is most of the stuff of his that I listen to is live. And it's such a simple theme which builds and builds and builds. Once I put a stopwatch on it because I was curious to work out whether it did actually speed up or it just felt like that. It does slightly speed up. It is a virtuoso pianist proving that it doesn't all need to be flash. It's about a very, very smart, clever theme taken in all directions. It's gorgeous. Thank you.
What are the things you most like in that?
There is a bravery to that. Mm. There is that tritone riff repeated. Mm. And in anybody else's hands, you might think it was just a lack of imagination, but it becomes mesmeric and intense. It's also a brilliant study in dynamics, you know, right to the end, building, 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 and then releasing. It's delicious. And there is something very therapeutic about that piece of music. It's gorgeous.
Cantabile, composed and performed live in Tokyo by Michel Petrucciani, with the bassist Anthony Jackson and the drummer Steve Gadd. Let's talk a little bit about your early life, Joe Rayner, which I think was in Harrow in northwest London.
Yeah, I grew up in Harrow. I went to school, fancy fee-paying school that didn't like me. I wear that as a badge of honour. They threw me out for a little while. I don't think it's a secret that my mother, Claire, was a journalist and broadcaster and a novelist. My father, Des, had been an actor, been in fashion PR and had become a painter. And so I grew up in a house where, and I've often said this, a lot of professions which to other people might seem unobtainable were to me just the job. There was no reason why I couldn't think about being a novelist or a broadcaster or a journalist or, God help me, a painter. I was okay at A-level, but then it all fell apart. What there wasn't much of, funnily enough, which is a bit surprising given the direction my life has taken, is music. Neither of my parents was a great musician. They had about 7 albums. Whenever they held a party, they had a stacking record player. And they played the same 7 albums, quite a lot of Sondheim, the cast recording of Company, the cast recording of A Little Night Music, maybe a Harry Nilsson if they were feeling a little more up to date. And food was marked by volume rather than finesse, is what I would say. Both my parents had had working class, meagre childhoods defined by the war. And they were absolutely clear that those privations would not be delivered on their children. So the table was always full in a very secular Northwest London Jewish way.
But it sounds as though they gave you a degree of confidence.
Well, I think I'm quite a classic youngest child in that. So, you know, as a parent, as I am now, you know, you experiment and you worry about the first and progressively get more and more relaxed until it's kind of, oh, just go out into the world and do your thing. And so by the time I came along, I was the third of 3. I think they reckoned they knew how to make this work. And yes, I was given quite a lot of lassitude. Confidence, yes, although if I'm really honest, I don't think it really sort of came to the fore until I'd left school. The school I went to was not a comfortable one. I did not feel appreciated or understood. But I went off to Leeds University, having chosen it because it had the biggest student newspaper in the country. And that's really where it all came together. I had a fantastic time at Leeds.
Just to go back for a moment to your parents, did you get on well, especially with your mum, given that she was dealing with other people's agonies?
Oh, yes, but I mean, no, I got on well with her, but not in that regard. You know, people say, well, who do you go to with your problems? Well, I don't go to her because she's still my mother. And the last thing I was really going to do was talk about the personal stuff with her. It was still a mother-son relationship in a very standard way. But it was an interesting life, actually. That house was full. Both my parents worked from home and there was an infrastructure of people to support them. And I never quite knew when I walked through the door at the end of the school day what I would find in the house. Classic thing was the light gels were up against the office windows. Oh, mum's working again.
Quite exciting, though.
Oh, yeah, 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 no, fun.
Gypsy next.
Well, this does sort of refer to my parents. Although I say my parents were not musical, they had a deep abiding love for musical theatre. They would go and see almost every musical going. And I have a very strong memory of going to see Gypsy with Angela Lansbury in the West End. I was 5 or 6 years old. I recall it in every detail. The overture to Gypsy, and I'm willing to have a big argument with anybody, the overture by Jules Stein, I think, is the greatest Broadway musical overture there is. It has everything you want. It sits hinged between the modern era and the shout back to the vaudeville era. If you listen carefully right at the beginning, there's a whoopee whistle that blows almost as if to say, we are back in vaudeville here. The arrangement is lush. The strings are firing. The horns are firing. It's everything you want from an overture to a musical, which is going to say, settle back. You're in for a great ride. Isn't that great?
Yeah. Energy, even if syncopated energy, fantastic. The overture from Gypsy, composed by Jules Stein and performed by the Gypsy Orchestra, conducted by Milton Rosenstock. When you went out to the musicals, would you go to a restaurant ever?
Yes. I mean, the classic one was a Boxing Day trip, and the tradition was a kind of classic Jewish Christmas, which was Chinese food and then a musical. But I was introduced to restaurants. If I have a love of restaurants, it's through my mother. My father was never that comfortable in them. But Claire, having found her way from that working class upbringing to the world of journalism, which is sort of an airlock through which, you know, people with meagre beginnings can move into a different world, came to love restaurants. She adored them, and she was determined to instill that love in us. I think it worked with me, don't you?
Although you spoke about volume over quality in those early days, I think you did develop quite a love for a Caesar salad.
Well, the Caesar salad is a marvellous thing if done well. There's a restaurant, it's still open today, Joe Allen. The original opened in New York in the 60s. It opened in London in 77, and the London outpost, if anything, became more famous than the original. It was the Theatreland favourite. And my parents first took me there when I was 10. And I surprised myself by realising that this garlicky, crisp, Parmesan cheese glory, served then in a wooden bowl, was something that I, as a greedy 10-year-old, absolutely loved. You've already mentioned that I've written a book full of recipes inspired by my favourite restaurant dishes, and coming up with a version of a Caesar salad, which is not one of the traduced versions that are so often around today. They're not meant to be covered in lumps of cotton wool chicken or spongy prawns. They are meant to be of themselves, anchovies meant to be in there, lots of fresh Parmesan, garlicky croutons. And so when I came up with one, I was thinking back to those early days at Joe Allen.
Now, Jay Rayner, we got on to Leeds, which meant that you rather smoothly didn't talk about your hugely distinguished career at Haberdasher Asks Boys' School in your teens.
Yeah, because it wasn't hugely distinguished, was it, Michael? I mean, I managed to stay there. I got thrown out for 4 months for getting wonderfully stoned at an after-school party. The irritating thing was that because Claire was well-known, that made it into all the newspapers. The billboards for the Evening Standard and the Daily Mail, a couple of kids at the school sold me out, and not for enough money, frankly. I was when I found out how much they got for the story in later life, it did mean that when I finally graduated and I was trying to make it as a journalist, I realised that all the cuttings libraries had all these cuttings, but I was getting work placements at places like the Telegraph and the Times or whatever. So I went to the library and I asked for the file on myself, and then I removed all the cuttings. I took them all out. I think I'm the only person with an actual paper set of those cuttings from 1983 and my lost summer.
But you did have one experience which must have been quite formative in a rather awful way, because you lost a close friend, didn't you? When you were only 16.
Yeah, David Solomons. He actually went to a different school. He went to University College School. And he was a mountaineer, and the school went on a mountaineering trip, and there was a terrible accident, and he and a teacher died, and a lot of them were injured, and a lot of the other kids were friends of mine as well. And it was a very drastic moment, actually, in their lives and our lives. And we just marked 40 years since that moment, just last year. And it was quite striking as all these men in their 50s came back to talk about just how impactful it had been on their lives. A lot of them really hadn't talked about it. A lot of them took a trip back to Snowdon, to the spot where David died. And it was something they had to face up to. What was quite striking, you know, I'm a parent now. I have two kids, one 25, one 20. And realising what we dealt with at the age of 16, 17, as we all were, was quite monumental. And in my mind, we dealt with it very, very well, very supportively.
When you got to Leeds, you were editor of the student newspaper. Did you feel that having that kind of responsibility, that ability to create journalism, helped you on your way in your later life?
It's the most brilliant start possible. I mean, the reason I chose Leeds was because the editorship, and it was one of, I think, only four in the country, was a full-time job. You had to be elected by a cross-campus vote, and I got in my head that if I could get elected editor, because students are all cynical, I could never be accused of having got where I am through nepotism because my mother was a journalist. I have to say, just jumping ahead, it didn't work. I still got accused of being where I am today through nepotism, even though Claire's been dead 14 years. But yeah, I was the editor of a tabloid newspaper, came out once a week, had a circulation of about 25,000 copies, a staff of between 90 and 120 people. I didn't go on to do a journalism course because I concluded that after a year of doing that as my full-time job, I would probably find it quite frustrating to be back in a classroom. And I don't regret that. I think it really did teach me the things I needed to know.
Music from Scheherazade, the Rimsky-Korsakov Scheherazade next.
Yes, in, I would say, 1986, I went off backpacking across Greece and Turkey by myself. I had a little Walkman and I had a collection of tape cassettes, including the yellow-fronted Deutsche Grammophon version of Scheherazade. And I must have worn it slack. It became the soundtrack of my wanderings across a hot and arid Greece and Turkey. And the great thing about the Walkman, obviously we're so familiar with it now, but it was the first time you could soundtrack your own life. And there is a grandeur to this. My wife, Pat, who is much more knowledgeable about classical music than I am, thinks it's slightly banal of me to like this. And I just roll my eyes at her. It may be. It is, and I think people will be spotting a theme, deeply romantic. But I just love the themes, and listening to it still takes me back to that moment as a very young man by myself having an adventure.
Thank you.
It's a wonderful score, isn't it? That sort of swirling sound of the sea.
Exactly. And if you imagine me island hopping across Greece and Turkey, constantly on ferries, churning through the blue waters of the Aegean, I mean, you can just hear it as a soundtrack, can't you?
The Sea and Sinbad's Ship from Scheherazade by Rimsky-Korsakov. We heard the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, and Lawrence Rock was playing the solo violin passages. The conductor was Alan Gilbert. Jay Rayner, you became food critic for The Observer in 1999. So for 25 years, you've been reviewing restaurants. What do you most love about it?
I never had any intention to be the restaurant critic for The Observer. I was not wandering around while writing pieces about art history or Lawrence Durrell or whatever, thinking, but what I really want to do is go out for dinner and write smart-ass things about it. It hadn't occurred to me that it might be the job I should be doing until the very moment when, over lunch, the editor of The Observer magazine said they needed a new restaurant critic, and my hand went up. I said, that's a job you can't advertise, because if you advertised it, the application pile would be huge. But actually, I love restaurants. I always read restaurant reviews. I think I'd be rather good at it. By that point in 99, I'd been working as a journalist full time for maybe 13 years. And truth be told, I was exhausted because I had been changing topic, subject, every single piece. And it struck me that to have a specialism would be a good thing. And that if ever there was a subject made for me, it was food. And what quickly became clear was that food isn't just about how things taste. It's about emotion and memory and history and relationships and politics and economics. It's about everything. And it just happened to be a subject that suited me greatly. I won't claim that I went into it thinking, that's me set for life. No newspaper columnist should ever think that. I thought if I got 3 years, I'd be lucky. At 10 years, I told my wife maybe it was time to quit and go back to doing proper journalism. And she laughed in my face, said, you won't. And here we are, Michael, 25 years later.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
How do you decide which restaurants to review?
It's very similar to how you decide what story to cover. It's got to be a variety. It can't just be French bistros every week. It's got to be a mixture of food types. It's got to be a mixture of location. I make a point of not just reviewing in London or paying lip service to reviewing outside London. Over 60% of my reviews are outside London. It's got to be different price points. But the key thing is I have to ask myself, what is the story here? What am I going to write 1,100 fully engaging words about? Because it can't just be, here's a plate of food, here's a table, here's a chair. I've got to find a way into that week's restaurant, which is about something else, actually. And so I'm always asking myself, what is the story?
And so do you apply the same kind of criteria to the dishes you choose from?
Well, they tend to present themselves as likely options. If something reads weirdly on a menu, then I'm going to order it. It's not my fault that you've written up this weird dish. If it's there, I'm going to have it. If there is a speciality for that restaurant, then I'm going to have it. I'm not going to order the steak and chips, which is only there for the people who didn't really want to go out for dinner anyway. I can't order the pork belly because I order too much of that. So certain things fall off the edge, and I can't order the stupid luxury things because they are just stupid luxuries for people who are trying to compensate for other lackings in their life. So you're trying to find things that will tell you something about the restaurant, what the kitchen can do, and more to the point, and this is really what a restaurant review is, how much pleasure will your money get you if you go to this place? That's my job.
What's the weirdest thing you've ever eaten in a restaurant?
Probably weirdest and also the most unpleasant was salt fermented sea cucumber in a Japanese, high-end Japanese restaurant, which didn't normally allow guys in through the door, foreigners. I had to eat everything. And there's a whole bunch of textural things that sort of slip off the Western palate. We're not used to them. And salt fermented sea cucumber, very slimy, very fishy, very intense. For me, it was just too much. And I had to finish it.
And do you try and remain anonymous?
Yes, I do. I try as much as it is possible within the constraints of being the big head one on MasterChef. But I can book under a pseudonym. I give no prior warning that I'm going to come. We pay all our own bills. My view is that it's like theatre. You know, if you go to theatre, the script's been written, the cast has been chosen, and it's been rehearsed. There's nothing they can do just because you're sitting in the stalls. By the same token, one of my colleagues once said he was yet to find a bad restaurant that became a good one just because he walked through the door. There's not much they can do, and anything they can attempt to do, I'm wise to.
Music by Madeline Dring next, Jay Rayner.
Yeah, this is a lovely piece. I knew nothing of Madeline Dring until I was sitting in a rehearsal for a concert that takes place every year, run by Lucy Parham, the pianist. She runs what she calls a celebrity piano gala, in which people who are not known for their music side play a piece. It was Alistair McGowan who introduced me to this. He and I were at university together. He has a pronounced interest in the piano. He's a very good pianist. And the piece he chose was Madeleine Dring's Colour Suite 4, Blue Air, and I thought it was gorgeous. I don't think it's any surprise that I like that, given everything I've already said about my love of jazz. It sounds like the soundtrack to a film noir, even going for that minor major seven right at the end. I did try listening to the rest of Dring's Colour Suite. Didn't like it anywhere near as much as I like Blue.
Yes, it's funny. I think possibly she was allowing herself to let her hair down there. She was an actress and a singer as well as a composer.
Yeah, it's a fascinating character. And as a result of hearing this piece, you know, I went and dug into her a bit more, trained with Vaughan Williams for a while. A really interesting character.
Blue Air from the Colour Suite for piano, composed by Madeleine Dring and performed there by Lee Kaplan. Jay, I was wondering whether you found it was actually easier and rather more enjoyable writing scathing reviews than trying to be positive about something which you just felt a bit lukewarm about.
Well, it's kind of true, but you can't indulge it. In other words, if all you did was write knocking copy, it would become repetitive and it wouldn't be particularly useful to the reader. So while on occasion, if I've gone to somewhere that was terrible, I can't claim that I didn't enjoy giving them their just desserts. You have to be very sparing with it.
I've got one here which I can't resist, which I love, where you say, the food was so dismal that you thought about eating a fellow diner's dog. You say, I find myself eyeing the Yorkshire Terrier greedily. Just hand him over. Give me access to the grill and 5 minutes.
Yeah, the Farm Girl Cafe. It was a sort of Australian-style healthy cafe on the Fulham Road. Yeah, and I did hate it with that. I mean, the cooking was just very, very poor. But you can't do that very, very much.
Has a chef ever got in touch with you after a bad review?
No, usually it's the chef's mother. Quite seriously, that's what's happened a couple of times. It's been a relation of the chef who has said, "You don't understand how hard they work and what they do. You are an awful, awful human being." And I just have to say, well, I'm sorry you feel that way, but I was doing my job.
Tell me about the next piece, which I think actually relates to an interview you did with a Polish composer in March 1999.
Yes, indeed. Władysław Szpilman, who was the eponymous pianist of the film of the same name. He was a pianist before the Second World War and a composer, and then ended up in the Warsaw Ghetto. He's Jewish. And then the Warsaw Ghetto was dissolved and he somehow survived. And he survived in the wreckage, all of which was described in the film. And then at the end of the war, he went back to playing the piano, and his Chopin nocturnes were very well known. He wrote a book about it, but then sort of put it away, and it was his son who found the book and got it published, and that led to the film. As a result of the film, I interviewed Szpilman, who was sort of an ordinary man who found himself in extraordinary circumstances. But there was also the release of a CD of some of his performances, but also this concertino for piano and orchestra, written in 1940 when he was 29 years old. Now, he was in the Warsaw Ghetto by this point. I find this piece incredibly moving and also quite funny, because anybody listening to this will hear it as exactly what it is, which is an utter rip-off of Gershwin. Here is a young man, an ambitious musician, and he is listening to the music, the cutting-edge music of the day, and what he wants to be. It is a howl of cosmopolitan ambition before the darkness falls. And there is nothing original about this, but it's beautiful when you put it in the context of the Warsaw Ghetto that it was written in.
Thank you.
I'm really grateful to you for introducing me to that. I actually didn't know it, but it's wonderful. Spot the similarities.
I played it to a friend of mine who said, Gershwin should sue. and it is all that. It is a youthful composition, isn't it? But as I say, once you put it in the context of the Warsaw Ghetto and the privations and the darkness falling across Europe, yeah, it's an extraordinary piece and very, very moving.
Jay, alongside your food writing and broadcasting, you're an accomplished jazz pianist. Did you have piano lessons as a child?
Oh, Michael, I rose to the lofty heights of grade three. so 2 or 3 years. It was a terrible piano. It never played properly. And I sometimes think, to be honest, that may have sort of dissuaded me from my classical lessons. But also, I was a feckless child. I do regret now that I didn't go further. I didn't attend to my scales and things like that. But we all come to these things in different ways. I was drawn to electronic music. I got synthesizers and I did a lot of that for a while until I was drawn back to blues piano. And it's been a long, old journey, culminating 2012 was when I finally started gigging properly as a jazz musician, when I finally felt I had enough knowledge in the company of some great musicians to gig.
I was wondering whether you tended to play by ear rather than sight read.
I am terrible at the dots. I mean, I can read a top line.
Can you pick up a tune quite quickly then?
Not badly. Yeah, not badly. Mm. I don't kill myself about what I can't do. I have a joke. It's at the beginning of gigs. I say I'm the greatest jazz pianist in Britain of all the critics on MasterChef. And it is a joke, and it's sort of undermining expectation, but I kind of mean it in that, given everything else I do and that this is not my main job, I think I'm okay. It's an ongoing process. I'm learning all the time. I love that process. I'm 58 now, and I think the idea that you can continue learning and continue expanding your repertoire and your knowledge is a beautiful thing.
Well, the quartet you formed in 2012 led to you releasing your first live album in 2017, and in 2022 you became a sextet. So what kind of tunes do you look for? What music really turns you on?
So I'll tell you what, back when we were a quartet, it was, what am I capable of playing? And what can I draw people into gigs with? So it was a mixture of food songs and anything that might pull on my growing up with an agony aunt as a mother, with Claire. And so we called it A Night of Food and Agony. Songs like Black Coffee, which is a perfect example of the two, actually. So we did a lot of that sort of stuff. When we decided to become a sextet, I said to the lead singer in the band, who I sleep with on a regular basis because it's my wife, Pat, I said, look, we've got to do something here. We can't just stay like this after 10 years. And the two of us met in Leeds in the 1980s, and we'd always been fascinated by the way a lot of chart hits in the 80s weren't just jazz-inflected, but were basically jazz and had somehow got up the charts. I'm talking about bands like Everything But the Girl, Working Week, certain things that Sting was obviously doing, Matt Bianco, Sade. Take those songs and not cover them, because anybody can be a cover band, that's dull. Treat them like songs from the Great American Songbook. And so that's a lot of what we do, and it's a journey into the 80s, and it's an awful lot of fun.
There's a pianist you particularly love, Bill Charlap.
Yeah, Bill Charlap is a New York-based pianist. I always say there are two sorts of jazz pianists. Those whose workings you can see in the margin, and you can see the technical thrills and spills. Oscar Peterson is a perfect example. And those you stop focusing on trying to work out what they're doing, you just listen. Bill Evans is one, and Bill Charlap is definitely in that category. It's sinuous and subtle. And the one you're going to play is Spring Can Really Hang You Up the Most. The original lyric, written by someone I knew as a kid, Fran Landsman, the beat poet, who was a friend of my parents. Music by Tommy Wolfe. In fact, I played this, the same gala performance that Al McGowan played the Madeleine Dring. And the way I often learn, the way I expand is I choose a tune or a song, one ideally with complexity, and then I work through it bar by bar by bar. Spring Can Really Hang You Up the Most. It's a beautiful tune. It's a beautiful performance by Bill Charlap.
Beautifully played.
It is beautifully played. And an example, sometimes people think jazz piano is all flash and vigour and look at me. And it doesn't have to be that. It can be soft and mellow and gentle.
Spring Can Really Hang You Up the Most, composed by Tommy Wolfe and performed by the Bill Charlap Trio. Your dad, I think, was present for your first public performance with your band. What did he make of it, Joe Rayner?
I think he was slightly startled, to be honest, because a lot of the musical development in my life had happened after I'd left home. And so it's one thing to say, oh, I'm doing this thing, oh, I'm doing this thing, yeah, this thing's happening. And then we're on stage at King's Place in King's Cross, and we're holding down the stage for an hour, playing some kicking tunes. And so my dad was slightly taken aback. He very beautifully said that my old mum, Claire, who died 2 years before, would have been very proud. And I do regret she never got to see us do it, because I think she would have loved it.
After your father died, you and your sister scattered your parents' ashes in different locations, including, rather appropriately, West End theatres.
Yeah, my dad had always said that as a painter he would never get into the Tate unless it was his ashes scattered on the steps. So we literally did that. We scattered my mother on the steps of the Royal College of Nursing. We went for lunch at one of their favourite restaurants, the Ivy, found a gap between the banquette and the bench, mixed them up, dropped them on the floor there. They're probably still there. And then I had a mate, Andy Nyman, who was playing the lead in Fiddler on the Roof. And I said, can we put some of their ashes around a plant pot backstage in your dressing room? They'd have loved that. And he said, I think I've got a better idea. We had to sneak up on stage before the matinee while the stage manager wasn't looking. And Andy showed us the villagers' set for Fiddler on the Roof. And here are the milk churns. And look here, the lids come off the milk churns. And we put my parents in there. And I like to say that they played 8 performances a week from April to November of that year. We only revealed we'd done it after the show had come off, because we didn't want the stage manager thinking he had to clean out the milk churns. And we like to think that those milk churns went into some prop store and that my old folks' remains keep coming out for ropey old productions of Oklahoma and Our Town and things like that.
We're going to hear the Kyrie from Missa Crioula now. Where did you encounter this?
So I've mentioned Pat, my wife. She's an academic publisher by trade, but she is a very fine singer. She's the secret weapon in the J. Rayner Sextet, but she's also sung with a number of choirs and sung classical. And one of the choirs she was performing with were about to do Ariela Ramirez's Missa Crioula, which I knew nothing of. There's not a spiritual bone in my body. But as was often the way, she was playing this on the sound system around the house. Ramirez liked to bring Argentinian folk music into the classical world. And I heard this, I just thought it was sublime. It's atmospheric from the first beat of the first drum. Thank you.
pretty forthright, isn't it?
It is. It is. It's a brilliant melding of those male voices and those beautiful choral chords. It's pure texture.
The Kyrie from the Missa Criolla, composed and performed by Ariel Ramirez, joined by Los Fronterizos, and conducted by Jesus Gabriel Zagada. Jay Rayner, your latest book, Nights Out at Home, celebrates the 25 years you've spent as a food critic. And I wonder, what is your favourite kind of place to eat? Is it somewhere classy, upmarket, humble, family-run? Or is it just simply where it is good?
Probably the latter, where it is good. But if I'm eating on my own dime, it's almost certainly, and I feel a bit of a cliche for this, it's almost certainly going to be a French bistro. That classic French paysan bistro repertoire just does it for me. It's a place of comfort. Doesn't mean it's the only thing I like. It absolutely isn't. But if I am going out to eat with friends, with my family or whatever, that's probably where I'm going to head towards. Although the book itself, which is recipes inspired by those favourite dishes of the past 25 years, has a lot of other stuff in it.
There was a very moving description of Esra Muslu's Turkish restaurant, Za'atar, for example.
Yeah, Za'atar is a great restaurant. It's still there, although I'm sad to say Esra is no longer with us. She died last year. It took us all by surprise because she was a young woman and it was very fast and very tragic. But hers was a modern version of the Turkish repertoire, but not just meaty. If you go to Green Lanes, where the Turkish community is focused in London, you would assume it's all lamb kebabs, but there's a hell of a lot more to Turkish food. And this particular dish is a whole globe artichoke stuffed with spiced rice. There's a lot going on in that dish. I came up with a version by myself, which wasn't far off it. And she later welcomed me into her kitchen, and it was an entirely female-run kitchen, women from the Turkish community, because she thought they would understand her dishes better. And she gave me a tutorial in how to make this multi-layered globe artichoke. And, you know, I'm pleased it's there because I suppose it stands as a bit of a memorial to Esra, who's a lovely, lovely person and taken from us far too young.
Well, bearing in mind that many of our listeners will be thinking about lunch, is there something that you regularly like to conjure up for a Sunday lunch?
This is quite boring, but the answer's good, which is I do love roasting a chicken. And interestingly, restaurants have never been very good at the domestic. People listening at home probably make far better roast potatoes than restaurants do, far better apple crumble than restaurants do. And roast chicken is a really interesting one, but there are a few set-piece ones. And after going to a place called L'Ami-Louis in Paris, which is this legendary bistro where Mitterrand took Clinton, for example, and Le Petit Maison in London, I came up with my own recipe for roast chicken, which is about lemon juice and butter and putting the giblets inside and putting bread croutons in the bottom so that they come out tasting of the chicken as well. And I recently was interviewed and someone said, what do you do better than anybody else? I said, I'd put my roast chicken up against anybody else's. It's a very grand claim, but I think I need to own it.
Tell me about this next track, Holy Devil.
Yes, Sophie Solomon, who is a terrific violinist, a musicologist, a curator. She does an awful lot of things. She's worked with the London Symphony Orchestra, with Richard Hawley, Katie Tunstall. But this particular album from 2006, Poison Sweet Madeira, I discovered it and I started listening to it at a particular point in my life when a lot of television work was happening and I was getting a bit anxious, truth be told. I was feeling the pressure. And some people are a bit surprised when I say, but this relaxed me because it's quite an intense piece of music. But it is fierce and dramatic and rather lovely. Thank you. Isn't that great? One of the interesting things to me as I've advanced as a musician is the way people want to define a genre. Most of the time, it doesn't really matter. It's music. I don't know what genre that is. Sophie had a start as a klezmer violinist. That is many things and much more besides. I think it's just fantastic.
Holy Devil, composed by Jonathan Hugh Quambe and Sophie Solomon, who played the violin there. Listening to that, I felt it was a bit like a kind of frantic kitchen, people racing around to try and get
I'll
things
take that,
going.
Yeah.
And I wondered whether you think things have changed a bit now from the sort of Hell's Kitchen featured on television and dramas like The Bear. Do you think things are a bit more sane?
I think they are, mostly because people just won't put up with it anymore. I mean, there's a lot of it still goes on, let's not pretend. And The Bear, three series now, about a kitchen in Chicago, has a lot of stress going on in it. But I don't think a lot of people are willing to put up with being bullied in the kitchen and being told it's so important that you have to put up with this abuse. And I think the pandemic had a lot to do with that as well. This sense that furloughed, a lot of people who'd been in kitchens in hospitality looked at their lives and went, why am I doing this? Why am I doing this to myself? I'm not going to do this anymore.
You feel, Jay, I think, privileged to be a food critic, although, of course, it has its downsides. You talk in the book about something called the Greenspan arse.
Yeah, well, that's a familial arse. My late cousin John Greenspan, who we lost only a year or two back, a very eminent academic, AIDS researcher and doctor, but he had a particular shape to him, which was sort of an apple round bottom, which I have. And the point actually I make is that I have always been a large man, and I don't think that the job is the reason why I am a large man. There's no skinny version of me who in 1999 went through a different sliding door and carried on as a reporter, investigative reporter, or a foreign correspondent. No, I was always a chunky guy. I was always going to be. Obviously, if you're paid to go into restaurants and eat all the pies, it's going to have an impact. But I wanted to be very clear about that. It helps that I'm a man. I think there's much more pressure on women in the profession to talk about that kind of body image, whereas they just look at me and go, oh, it's just him, the one with the hair and the beard. But I go to the gym a lot, an awful lot. I'm in the gym four times a week, at least. And I watch what I eat because, you know, I like life and the best way to be alive is not to be dead.
Tell me about your final piece of music.
Ray emerged, well, she's been around for a while, but she really emerged with her album 21st Century Blues. And I'm going to just fanboy. I think she is an astonishing talent, a brilliant singer, a brilliant performer, a brilliant jazz singer, and a brilliant composer. She's, you know, smashed through the pop charts. She won 7 Brits, the greatest number of any one artist. But then earlier this year, she was at the Royal Albert Hall with the Heritage Orchestra under the baton of a superb chap who I know a little bit called Tom Richards. He's a great arranger. And I just think she's spectacular, and I can't wait to see how she develops as an artist. This song, Worth It, came in the middle of the Royal Albert Hall performance, and I think it's terrific. I really do.
So it only remains for me to say, Jay Rayner, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a delight.
Was a boat, could you steer that sailor? Make it feel like it's a 1960s Hollywood trailer. Classic like Cars, classic like Elizabeth Taylor. Yeah, need you to romance me, yeah, need to give another take. But baby boy, no, I could love you, you, if I really wanted to do, do. You could be my glass of wine. Sunset, tell me exhale or no. Baby, 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 with you. Would you make it alright? Or maybe that much better. If you wanted, you could make it all worth it.
Worth it, worth it, worth it.
When I see the sunrise, if you make it that much better. So I hope you're gonna make it all worth it.
This is the night. Something about it's making me.
Chardonnay 2016, babe. Something like a dream, babe. Somehow I'm so captured by you, and I'm rearranging all of my plans as I'm holding my breath as I hope you.
Worth It, performed by Ray and the Heritage Orchestra, the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the restaurant critic and broadcaster Jay Rayner. Private Passions was produced by Claire Walker, and next week Michael Barclay's guest will be the actor Lucien M'Samati. In a few moments, Sarah Moore-Peach maps the musical terrain around Holst's Suite No. 1 for Military Band, marching down sonic avenues that link music across time and space. From folk-inspired music by Ray Vaughan Williams and Ruth Crawford Seeger to music for the outdoors by Handel and Mozart, Sarah charts a musical journey towards Holst's seminal wind band piece.
Live music lives on BBC Radio 3.
Enjoy live chamber music concerts every week on Classical Live. Intimate performances from one of the UK's favourite venues, Wigmore Hall, London.
The audience loving this performance, lots of them on their feet.
Live chamber music from Wigmore Hall on Classical Live, tomorrow afternoon from 1.
Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
And a very warm welcome from me, Al Ryan, if you just joined us this afternoon here on BBC Radio 3, where all this week we've been celebrating the life and music of Gustav Holst, born 150 years ago yesterday. And right now, his music is the subject of our Sunday afternoon musical journey. Here's Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello and welcome to Music Map, the show here on Radio 3 where we chart a course towards a single musical destination, listening across the ages to sounds that are woven into its DNA. Today we're mapping a piece of music that anyone who's ever played in a wind band will know and love. Thank you. Gustav Holst wrote his first suite for military band in 1909. Three modest movements, but they seem to encompass so much, from Baroque counterpoint to the search for musical economy, not to mention the call to dance. We'll be listening around some of these connections, but let's start by spooling forward in time to another much-loved work from the same stable, the Folk Song Suite by Ralph Vaughan Williams. 15 years later, and without his friend and colleague Holst having led the way, he'd probably never have written this.